So, say, I just need to say something about tutorials, right?
Oh, yeah. So, the... did I see something on the email?
Yes. Yes.
So, basically, there, on the course webpage...
Yeah, I saw the links.
Links, if they are not on the mailing list.
Yeah.
About 136
okay.
of them were on the mailing list.
Okay. Oh, that's pretty good.
Since then, it's grown.
Okay.
So those people definitely didn't get it, and I suspect IT was not done.
They're not done?
They're not done.
Okay. Yep.
So
well, hopefully...
They were pretty... So when I talked to them last... when I last talked to them, their estimate of the MSc class was 135.
Wait, the total MSc?
No, 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 the total MSc. I'm just giving you a
it's a lot less than that. That's small.
Well, in fact, there was over 170 students. So
oh.
They were off by 40 on the MSc.
Oh, I see, I see.
The UG3s are done.
Okay. Okay.
But MSc, so there's potentially somewhere around 40 people that's
right.
That have not received the email.
Now, okay.
Not all of them would register for email.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I guess the only thing I guess we can do is I'll make an announcement at the beginning, and then you can make an announcement. I'll remind you to make another announcement at the end of the latecomers.
Yeah.
And that's all we can do. Yeah.
Oh, so ask them if they have friends who didn't get the email.
And when should we send... Oh, I guess... and that'll be their assignment, because they're only picking one. So if they made the choice, then they should show up to that tutorial. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, so there's not a... Yeah, so there's... Right, so I'm not going to say, oh, we'll send out another email with the assignments.
If they complain, then we'll be flexible.
Yes, yes.
I really don't...
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I agree. It doesn't make sense. Okay, good. I know. Okay. And so you're ready. So I'll probably go like 10, 12 minutes. And then I'll do my best. Too. Okay, thanks. So let's go ahead and get started. So there's one announcement that I want to go through before we finish up the lecture from last time. And it is about the tutorials. So the tutorials will begin next. So there was an email sent out to the class, but to the class mailing list. But that list is not yet complete, so I want to make that announcement in class as well. So the tutorials will start next week on Monday. We have a Doodle poll where you can sign up for your tutorial slot. If you haven't done that already, please do that soon. So you can get the link to that Doodle poll either in the email that you got from Victor, if you received that email, or it is also on the course webpage. So either way, make sure to go and sign up for a tutorial section and a lab section. And once you've signed up for the sections, that's what you should show up for. Next week, we have tutorials, but not labs. Okay, so sign up for tutorial section and then go to that section next week. And the other thing is, you know, it looks like most people in the class are in the room. I guess those people haven't heard what I just said. Make sure to tell your friends, since we have this delay in starting up due to the size of the class. Make sure to tell your friends, you know, if they haven't seen the email to sign up for tutorials and labs as well. Okay, so I'm going to start by last time we talked about basic probability, and we started talking about Gaussian distributions. So we saw that Gaussian distribution is a bell-shaped curve. Its equation is some other stuff. The important part of the equation is that it's e to the minus x squared. And then we saw so this gives you the probability density function for a univariate Gaussian. And we started talking about how to generalize that to the bivariate case and to the multivariate case. In the bivariate case, we saw that a Gaussian typically always looks like this. It's like a single, it's like a bell curve in two dimensions, although it can be squished or it can be slanted. And all of the, if you look at all of the level sets of the Gaussian distribution, so if you think of this thing like a mountain,
I could make a map by, you think like a topographic map gives you these contours at different heights of the mountain. I can make contours of when this probability density has equal density. So I can say, what is the set of points that all have probability, that all have the density function be 0.4? And that the sets that I'll get will look like this. They'll be ellipses. And that's true of any multivariate Gaussian. So they basically all look like this. And we saw the equation was for a bivariate Gaussian. I have the equation here, is basically the same as a univariate Gaussian, except you have it in this matrix language rather than in just having scalars. So we saw, well, this thing sigma is a matrix. It's a d by d. It's a d by d matrix where d is the dimensionality of the Gaussian. So for a bivariate Gaussian, this is going to be a 2x2 matrix, and this gives gives the covariance of the Gaussian. So whereas for a univariate Gaussian, we had 1 over sigma squared, here we have the inverse of the matrix big sigma, and then we also have x minus mu squared. So we have a quadratic form with this matrix, where in the scalar version we had x minus mu squared over sigma squared. So it's basically the same thing. So it's really the same form. The first time you see it, it looks a little bit scary, but once you work with it, you realize it's not, and it just looks like this. And that's true for any multivariate Gaussian. So if I wanted to have a Gaussian over 10 variables or over 100 variables, it actually looks the same. It just looks like, except now this thing sigma, instead of being a 2x2 covariance matrix, it's going to be d by d or 100x100. But the form of the equation looks exactly the same. So this thing, if you haven't seen covariances before, a covariance is is basically a measure of the amount of linear dependence between two variables. So if I have a... you get to see my new chalk. I don't get a round of applause for that. Okay. So... I'm not going to tell you where I got this from. So if I have a set of points that look like this, right, these are very close to a straight line. If I drew a straight line through them, it looks like, that line has positive slope. So if I call these things, say I call each of these points xi for I in 1 through n. So this will be... xi, we'll say this is x and this is y, so we'll have xi, yi. So we have the covariance matrix is the expectation of xi minus mu I times xj minus mu j. In the, if I want to get the covariance from a sample, it's going to look exactly like that, except instead of doing the integral for the covariance, we do a sum. So what we'll have is the sample covariance is going to be something like 1 over... this is the covariance, so it'd be 1 over root n sum I equals 1 through n of xi minus mu x times yi minus mu y. What's going to happen is if I have something, so actually if you look through that equation, what you can see is that if the two variables are strongly related, then when x is above its mean, y is going to be above its mean. And so I'll get a lot of positive terms here. Whereas for these points down here, x is below its mean, so this is going to be negative, and y is below its mean, so it's going to be negative. So when I have two variables that are that are related by a positive line, I'm going to get a positive covariance. And similarly, if I have a point set that looks like this, that's going to have negative covariance because this looks like a linear relationship that has negative slope. Whereas if I have a set of points, so this is negative covariance, and if I have a set of points that just looks like this, just looks like a cloud, that's going to have a covariance of around zero. So for every pair, so if I have a multivariate Gaussian, every pair of variables is going to have a covariance like this, and that matrix sigma is just the set of all possible covariances. It's a matrix containing all of the n squared different covariances. Now, this matrix, this is a symmetric matrix. The reason is if I flipped y and x, if I flipped the meaning of y and x here, I'd still get the same thing. So the covariance between x and y is the same as the covariance between y and x, and so I'll get a symmetric matrix here. Okay, so that's multivariate Gaussian. So all of these distributions that we've talked about, they have parameters. So for example, for a Gaussian, the parameters were the mean and the variance. What if I had a data set and I don't know the parameters? So then what I want to do is I want to estimate the parameters of that distribution. And so we'll finish up the probability lecture by talking about a method of a general framework for estimating parameters that we'll see that gives you reasonable answers for these kinds of Gaussian problems, and that we'll also use for some of the classifiers that we'll be talking about in the course. This method of estimation uses something called the likelihood. So the idea behind all of these things is I have some data set. So I'll have some set of points x from xi equals 1 through n, and I believe they're generated from some kind of nice distribution. So for example, I might believe that they're multivariate Gaussian, or I might believe that they come from a uniform distribution, but I don't know the range, or you know, maybe they come from some kind of discrete distribution. And I want to figure out what those parameters are. So the idea behind the maximum likelihood approach is, well, I have a probability distribution that I believe in. So if, say, m is going to index the different probability distributions that I'm trying to choose between on the basis of the data. So each one of these models m is going to give some probability to this data set that I observed. So if I've sampled all the data set, if I've sampled all the data items randomly, then all of these things xi, if I've sampled them independently randomly from some population, then these things xi are going to be independent, and they're going to have and each one's going to have the same distribution. So if you remember from independence from last time, independence of random variables means you take a product. So if I have a data set of D, D is the set of data of all data items, and all of these data items are independent, then the probability of seeing the whole set is the product of the probabilities of seeing each individual one. Okay, so now the idea behind, the likelihood is just this probability taken as a function of M instead of as a function of X. So if I fix the probability distribution, I get a distribution over x. But if I fix the data and then look at this thing as a function of the model, as a function of what probability distribution I'm using, then this thing becomes a function of m, and that function is called the likelihood. And so what we're going to do to estimate parameters, or to choose which probability distribution, in general to choose which distribution is actually correct, it actually best fits the data, is I'll just choose the m that maximizes this function. So that's a maximum likelihood approach. Here's an example of this in a discrete setting. Suppose I were to flip a coin 20 times and get the data up here, but you don't really trust me, which is pretty reasonable. And so you want to know, what kind of coin did I generate it from? Was it a fair coin? Was it a coin that had, so that would be one in which both had a 1 and 0 are equally likely. I think this must be an error in the slides, right? Or was it generated from a coin that only had heads on both sides? So there's no possibility of getting a zero. Or was it generated from a die? Maybe I rolled a die between 1 and 6, and it just so happened, and maybe subtract 1 from it or something. Well, you could do it in a couple of different ways. But I could roll a die that has 1 and 6, and I tell you 1 if it was 1, and tell you 0 if it wasn't 1. That could have generated this data as well. So which one of those things is a best fit to the data? So what you can do is simply say, well, each one of these is a probability distribution of the data. So what's the likelihood of both of them? So you can compute for a fair coin the likelihood, you know, each one of these things is equally likely. So the probability of getting this whole string is just of length 20 is just a half to the 20th, which is this very small number. And any other sequence would have been the same. Whereas for this for model, so that's the likelihood of model 1. For model 2, then I had only a 1 in 6 chance of getting the 1s and a 5 in 6 chance of getting the 0s. But the numbers are almost equal, right? So this doesn't seem like it would have been generated by this model. And indeed, this has a worse likelihood. And of course, since I actually did see 0s here, then there's no likelihood at all. The likelihood is 0 that I would generate that this came from a double-headed coin. So of these three, this m equals 1, a fair coin, is the maximum likelihood solution among these three choices.
And notice when you're maximizing the likelihood, one thing to take away is you're always maximizing it with regard to some model space. So in this case, it was a fairly stupid model space. And so when we really use it, we're going to use kind of some more clever model spaces. So one way to be more clever is to take a continuous model space. So we'll say it's some coin that isn't fair. So it comes up heads with some probability theta, but I don't necessarily believe that theta equals 1/2. So then what I can do, if I want to take the maximum likelihood solution, I have to use calculus. Because this thing is a continuous function of theta, and the way that we optimize continuous functions is we set the derivative to 0. So what we have here is a fancy way of a fancy equation for writing the likelihood of a coin. So what this is well, the, if it came up heads c times and tails c times, then this is the equation for the probability of the sequence of rolls that I got. And if you differentiate, you can differentiate this with respect to theta. In fact, it turns out it's easier to differentiate with respect to log theta. And you can set that to 0 and solve for theta. The details are on the slide. I'll leave this as an exercise. And it turns out that you get your estimate of theta is take the number of times that it came up heads over the number of times that you flipped the coin. And I hope that if I hadn't told you about maximum likelihood, that's hopefully the way you would have estimated how often the coin is to come up heads. So with the likelihood, remember the likelihood, it's useful to actually plot the likelihood and see what it looks like. So for this particular data set where I flipped the coin 20 times and got 9 heads, I get a graph that looks like this. So you see it's not exactly symmetric. It only goes between 0 and 1 because this thing theta was a probability. It can only be between 0 and 1. And it's kind of smooth and it has some maximum just under 1/2. With a different data set, this curve would look a bit different. It'd be centered somewhere else. And you also see this is the log of the likelihood, so that's why these are all negative. And you see it isn't a probability distribution over theta. If I integrated this over theta, I wouldn't get 1, right? Because it's given theta, I have a probability distribution. But if I just look at it as a function of theta, I don't. Okay, so you can do the same thing for a univariate Gaussian. It's the same kind of procedure. What you do is you take if you have some data x and you want to know what the mean, if you want to estimate the mean in the standard deviation, again, you just take the log of the probability density, and it turns out once you take that equation on the previous slide, this is a univariate Gaussian. When this log hits this, things break apart, and you get this thing which actually looks fairly nice. And you can differentiate with respect to those two parameters, and what you get is estimate the mean by the sample mean and estimate the variance by something that's almost the standard, almost the variance, the typical estimator for the variance, but notice you're dividing by n. And it's pretty easy to show that using calculus. So in those two cases, maximum likelihood gives you a pretty reasonable answer. It's not always guaranteed to give you a reasonable answer, although I guess we maybe won't see in this course where it doesn't. And you can do the same thing for a multivariate Gaussian, and basically you get the same thing as for the univariate, but you get it in matrix notation in vector notation rather than in matrix notation. Notice this thing here is an outer product, so you actually get an n by n matrix for this thing. If you look at any component of this matrix, you get something that actually looks like that. So what you get if you do maximum likelihood, so say this is a set of data that was generated from some Gaussian distribution, I can do maximum likelihood estimation of a Gaussian, and then say for each point here, I'll color it, so for every place here, 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 I'll color it according to the probability density given by the maximum likelihood Gaussian. And then what you get is something like this. So you get that most of the actual observed data set is in a high probability region according to the Gaussian, and then a few of them that are outside are in low probability regions, which is what you would expect. Okay, so that's basically the whirlwind tour of probability. And after this, we're going to go on and start talking about actual classifiers. So before we do this, are there any questions about probability? Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't know. Well, we'll do both. Yeah.
Okay. So, what we're doing, finding the maximum likelihood, given a fixed data.
It's not a distribution over the models. It's just a score. It's just a score function. It's a rating of the models. The reason why it's not, if you look at, maybe if you go back to this example. That's right. That's right. And we'll actually, we will talk about that point. Do we talk about Bayesian methods at all? No. So if in the MLPR course in the spring, you'll actually talk about ways where you actually do get a distribution over the different models. So in this case, you'd actually have these three scores would actually sum to one. As you see, they don't in this example. But as you say, to do that, you need a prior distribution of the models. We won't go into that in this course, but there are other machine learning courses where we do that do focus on that. So that's called Bayesian statistics when you do things that way. Yeah, was there another question?
Well, so just to sort of summarize that then, it's we basically, we've given a data set, we don't know anything about it, and we're basically trying to find a model that correlates the best to that data set.
Yes, I think that's right, and I would just make the one proviso that when you say you don't know anything about it, there are assumptions that you're incorporating in here. And the assumptions come from, what are my choices of possible M? Right, so, but apart from that, I agree with your summary. Yeah. Okay, great. Was there anything else? Yeah, so this is actually, the maximum likelihood part is pretty important, because it is going to come up in a couple of the other classifiers that we talk about. So it's good to actually understand that. Okay, so do you want to, you can start plugging in, and if you think of anything else, you can ask while Victor's plugging in.
All right, so we're going to continue talking about probabilistic methods, and what I'll be talking about today is the naive Bayes classifier. So this is the application of the probability estimation that Charles has covered, an application to the problem of classification. So classification, you get some data point, and you want to predict a class label for this. So here's an overview. I'm going to talk about the naive Bayes classifier, really focusing on the components and their function. Then, depending on how much time we have, we'll go through an example of a continuous naive Bayes, so basically a two-dimensional Gaussian, and a discrete example, so something spam classification with Bernoulli naive Bayes. And then I have a little bit to say about the pros and cons of naive Bayes, but this will probably come at the next lecture. So Bayesian classification in general. Remember, the classification problem is we're trying to construct a function f that's going to take some data as input, some individual, and try to predict something for them, right? So the y, what we're predicting, this is usually a class label in classification. So if you think about spam detection, it's just binary, ham or spam. If you think about classifying handwritten digits, you actually have 10 different values of y, depending on which digit you're recognizing. And then the x, thinking back two lectures, remember, we talked about representation, how we can represent a data item as a vector of values or as a set of attribute value pairs. So that's our x. And x1 through xn are the particular values for the attributes which we're using to represent the data, right? So those could be, remember, we talked about pixels or word presence or absence for spam. That's what the x1 through xn are. Now, in probabilistic classification, what you try to do... This is kind of interesting. In probabilistic classification, what you try to do is you construct a probability distribution over the classes. So your Ys, what you want to predict, whether it's ham or spam, you're not going to just output a decision, yes or no, yes it's spam or no it's not spam. You're going to come up with a probability distribution over the outcomes. So this PY given X, this is the probability that a particular email is spam. In probabilistic classification, when you need to make a decision, what you do is you pick the option, you pick the class that has the highest posterior probability. So if Y can have values spam or ham, I'm going to construct P of probability of spam given the email, probability of ham given the email, and then pick whichever one is the biggest as the classification. So that's the argmax. Now, so this is probabilistic classification in general. The Bayesian flavor of probabilistic classification is when you flip the probabilities around, when you use the Bayes rule to estimate this PY given X, right? So now note, you don't have to do it. You can actually, there are methods that estimate PY given X directly. So Bayes rule is not something automatic. But that's something that you can do as a choice. So you could say, I want, for whatever reasons, and we'll talk about those reasons, you could say, I want to flip the probabilities, and rather than estimating probability of Y given X directly, I may know how to compute probability of X given Y, and then I'm going to combine that with a prior over the classes, a priori, how likely is any email to be ham or spam. And another term, so this is the probability of X. I'm just expanding it in a certain form. So this is basically the Bayes rule, and all you're doing is you're just flipping the probabilities. So again, there's three components. This is the prior, the class model. So this is, and we'll actually talk about all of them, and this is the normalizer. Each one of them has a particular purpose that it serves in classification, and it's good to go over that and sort of know what each one of them does as far as the classifier is concerned. Now let's go over this, and for this slide I'm going to be using an example. So suppose I'm trying to classify a patient as to whether or not he has a particular disease. So a few years ago, avian flu was all the rage, right? So suppose you are you're a doctor and the patient comes in and you have a certain set of test results for that patient's or symptoms, and you're trying to decide, well, does he have a common flu or does he have an avian flu? So Y is the class value, and again, it can have two possible values. Let's say that one value for Y is common cold, and another one is avian flu, and X is a set of symptoms that you're seeing. So these could either be test results or just what the patient is telling you they're seeing. So, what is the purpose of the components? P of Y, the prior, the goal of this is to say a priori, before you see the symptoms, how likely is that a patient has avian flu versus common cold? And of course, avian flu is a very infrequent disease. So a priori, before you see the symptoms, you would be much more likely to say that they have a common cold. Right? So that's the purpose of the prior. The purpose of the prior is to put things in perspective. So if one out of a million people has avian flu, then the odds of this guy having an avian flu are affected by that in some way. Okay, now the model itself, P of X given Y, this is assuming he has avian flu, do his symptoms actually look like symptoms of an avian flu? So this is the class conditional model where you will construct a probability distribution over symptoms, X, assuming that the guy has a particular, that the guy falls into a particular class, Y, avian flu. And the purpose of the normalizer, P of X, the denominator, is to normalize the values of the probabilities across different observations. So let me give you an example of what exactly this means. So suppose, now I'm going to switch examples. Suppose you're doing digit recognition, right? The normalizer is really all about, the best way to see why it's needed is to think about outliers. So suppose I'm doing digit recognition, I have some examples of digit 3, and I may be constructing some representation. So this y equals 3, think of it as the Bayesian classifier's representation of what digit 3 should look like, right? This is the same for digit 6, and I have a few examples. So suppose that these are actually testing examples. I'm trying to classify them. And now suppose I get the following example over there, right? So you look at that. That's actually a 3, but it's corrupted in some way, right? So half the pixels are just flipped to black uniformly, right? Now, if you look at the probability P of X given Y of this outlier under the 3 class and the 6 class, it is going to be more probable under the 3 class. It doesn't look like either 3 or 6. It looks a little bit more like a 3 than a 6, but it really doesn't look like either of them. So the problem is, if you tried to classify all of these examples, the probability of this 6, or let's say this one, the probability of this 6 under the 3 class would actually be higher than the probability of that outlier. So that's a problem, right? Outliers are examples which are far away from any from any class center, in a way. So think about it that way. An outlier is far away, so it's going to be it's going to look very unlikely under every class. And that's what the normalizer does. The normalizer is the summation of these conditional probabilities over all the classes. So something that's an outlier, it's going to have a small px given y for every class y. So when you add them up, you get a small number. And then you're taking that prediction under 3 and dividing it by a small number. Effectively, what this does is that it brings that outlier to the same, it brings the probabilities for it to the same scale, to the same level as the predictions for these guys. So that's the purpose of the normalizer. So naive Bayes, 3 components, the class conditional model, if he has avian flu, how likely are his symptoms, the prior, how likely is avian flu before you see anything, and normalizer, which put things on a common scale. Right. So it's interesting to bring to talk about this a little bit. Naive Bayes is so there's 2 types of classifiers in machine learning. There is generative classifiers and discriminative classifiers. Now, almost everything that we talk about in this course is going to be discriminative. But a naive Bayes is an example of a generative classifier. So it's good to bring it up. So by the way, somebody was talking about the Bayesian learning. A lot of those are generative models as well. So naive Bayes is sort of the simplest example of a generative classifier. Now, so what does it mean? What is the difference between generative and discriminative classifiers? Generative classifiers try to somehow estimate what you want, the classification probability, py given x, from p of x given y. So what is p of x given y? Now think about this. P of x given y is a model of what observations should look like for a particular class type. So if you have if your class is digit 3, P of X given Y is a distribution that should tell you what are all the possible 3s, what do they all look like? If the class is avian flu, P of X given Y is what does the distribution over the symptoms look like assuming that the guy has avian flu. So it's a generative model in the sense that once you have this probability distribution, you can actually sample from it. And what are you going to sample? So if you sample from PX given Y, you sample X's. And X's are observations. So if you're doing digits, X's are bitmaps. So you can randomly draw bitmaps from a generative model. Or you can randomly draw patients, if you like. Sets of symptoms, really. That's the characteristic of a generative model. Not all probabilistic classifiers do that. It's perfectly possible to estimate P of Y given X directly. So you don't actually have to flip it with Bayes' rule. Something like a log linear model or a Maxent model, that will estimate P of Y given X directly given a set of feature functions. So it's not trying to model the observations directly. There's also sort of a really simple way to think about this graphically, and that's sort of with a picture like that. If you have a discriminative classifier, it only cares about the boundary between the classes. A generative classifier tries to describe an entire population. So if I'm trying to separate the black dots from the white dots, a generative classifier tries to model all of the black dots, all of them. And the discriminative classifier will generally only care about the dots that are close to the opposite class. So we briefly mentioned decision boundaries. So this would be the decision boundary for a discriminative classifier, and that's all it cares about. So naive Bayes is our only example of a generative classifier in this course. All right. So now let's talk about an independence assumption. So. And why we need this. Up until now, we were talking about Bayesian classifiers and not actually naive Bayes. What makes naive Bayes naive is the independence assumption that we're going to make. So basically, what are we going to do is we're going to assume that the components x1 through xn of each data item are conditionally independent given the class. Why do we need to do that? The reason we need to do that is think about what the alternatives are, right? So what if we don't make an assumption? What if we just, if we don't make an assumption, what can we do? One thing we can do in statistics and probability is we can count, right? So if you have a particular class, say a digit 3, you have some examples of digit 3, and examples consist of a set of pixels, and we can just perhaps start counting how many times we saw different configurations of pixels. There is a problem with that, and the problem is if you think about the total number of configurations, it's really pretty huge, right? So even in a toy example, so suppose I'm dealing with digits which are 20 by 20 black and white bitmaps, right? 20 by 20 is 400 pixels. Each pixel can be black or white. So the total number of bitmaps is 2 raised to 400. That's a very big number. So in fact, you wouldn't be able to count that many patterns, even if you had infinite amounts of training data. So this is a problem. If you wanted to just take x1 through xn and count how many times you saw a particular observation, you just can't do it. There are too many possible observations. And this is just a toy example. If you tried to do this for spam, I mean, you're looking at something like 2 to 10,000 or 2 to 100,000. So it's completely impossible to count patterns directly. So what you have to do is you have to do something else. And a simple thing that you could do is instead of counting the entire vectors and seeing how many times do I see this 400-dimensional vector, you count the individual components of those vectors. You count the individual attributes, the individual variables, right? So instead of counting the entire bitmap, you take the number 3 and count how many times did I see a black pixel in the upper left corner by itself without looking at anything else, just that pixel, right? And then you do the same thing for the next pixel and you repeat it 400 times, but you do it independently So each pixel, you would count it separately from the rest. So that's what naive Bayes does. And a mathematical assumption that allows you to do that is called the independence assumption. Right? So that's if you assume that the attributes x1 through xn are conditionally independent given the class, then you can, in fact, count them separately. And usually you have plenty of data to do that. So that's why you need an independence assumption. Now, mathematically, what does an independence assumption do? So remember, this is what we're after. This is what we want. We want to have the probability of getting this bitmap given a particular class value. So a way to break it down into components is in the following two steps. So in the first step, I'm just applying the chain rule from probability, right? So what I'm doing is I'm breaking the sequence x1 through xd to a product of conditionals. And at each point, I'm conditioning each pixel xi on everything that came before it and on the class y. So this is actually exact. You don't need to make any assumptions for doing that. That's just the definition in the probability calculus, right? It's the definition of the conditional probability. The independence assumption comes at the next step. The conditional independence here means that if I know the value of y, if I know that this is the digit 3, I don't need to look at any other pixels except the ith pixel. The probability of the ith pixel is determined by the class y. It's independent of all the other pixels, assuming I know the class. So that's the independence assumption, and that's what it allows you to do. In practical terms, this is something that you can't do. You can't count. This is something completely infeasible to even try. And this is something that you can do pretty easily, right? Because these numbers, P of xi given y, it's just a small number. It's how many times did I see a black here as opposed to a white in the class 3, right? So this is very manageable. It's worth reiterating on conditional independence versus mutual independence. Charles talked about that at the last lecture. It's a very important concept. Conditional independence and mutual independence are different beasts, right? If we assumed mutual independence, we couldn't actually classify anything. We're assuming something totally different. So let me give you an example. So suppose I have three events. So I have, just two events are enough. So the one event is I go to the beach, and the second event is I get a heat stroke, right? Now, these two events, you cannot say that they're independent of each other, right? Why is that? Well, because if you look at lots of examples where people went to the beach and got a heat stroke, you will see a lot more of them than what you would expect by chance. So if you just take the probability of going to the beach and multiply it by the probability of getting a heat stroke, if they were independent, the probability of beach and heat stroke should be just their product, right? And it's not, right? Going to the beach and getting a heat stroke are related things. So you cannot assume that they're independent of each other. But what you can do is you can assume that they're conditionally independent. If there is a certain factor that underlies both of them, that influences both of these events. So, for example, if you know that the weather is hot today, this may be a factor that explains the correlation between going to the beach and getting a heat stroke. After all, if the weather is not hot, going to the beach is not going to cause a heat stroke, right? It's not the beach that causes the heat stroke. It's the temperature. So if you do have another variable, hot weather, that influences both going to the beach and getting a heat stroke, then going to the beach and getting a heat stroke are conditionally independent given that the weather is hot or not. Right? So that's the difference. Things can be very dependent on each other, but there may be a factor that explains this dependence. Now, the way this is used in classification, the way we're using it in naive Bayes, is we're saying that this factor that explains the correlations between going to the beach and getting a heat stroke is the class label. That's the assumption. The assumption is that the class label is this latent, hidden factor that explains all the variance within your representation. All right, so that was naive Bayes classifier. We do have, I guess we have about 6 minutes, so we'll try to go through a continuous example. We might not get through all of it. So let's look at a specific example. So suppose you have two attributes, they're real valued. One attribute is the height. What we're gonna be doing is we're gonna be trying to differentiate children from adults, and not necessarily human, just some child species from some adult species. And we have two attributes. We have their height in centimeters, and we have their weight in kilograms. So suppose that I have a data set which has four adults and 12 children. So the examples will be triples of this form. So the HI is the height of the ith individual, WI is the weight of the ith individual, and YI is the class, whether they are a child or an adult. So if I have four adults and 12 children, I can immediately compute the priors. So remember the prior, that's what skews your estimates from naive Bayes. That tells you a priori how likely is somebody to be a child or an adult. So in this case, it's very simple. I have four adults, so the probability, the prior probability of an adult is a quarter, sort of 4 out of 16. And the prior probability of a child is 0.75. Now, how am I going to model these populations? I need to, in a Bayesian classifier, I need to model the adults and I need to model the children. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to construct a Gaussian for the adults and I'm going to construct a Gaussian for the children. And because I'm doing naive Bayes, this Gaussian will actually factorize into two independent Gaussians that I'm going to multiply together. So think back to Charles's lecture. Charles was talking about covariance and correlation. When you have covariance and correlation only when the variables are dependent on each other, right? In naive Bayes, you assume that the variables are independent, so your Gaussian will have a covariance matrix that is diagonal. In our case, we only have two components, so it's only going to have two numbers, and the other two are going to be zeros. What that means in practice is that this this bump, this Gaussian bump, cannot be oriented. It cannot be diagonal. It has to be sort of axis aligned. It's either spherical or it's elliptical. It's elongated along one axis or the other axis, but you can't turn it. That's what it means to have a diagonal covariance. Right. So effectively, we can think of it as two independent Gaussians, one for the x's and one for the y's, one for the height and one for the weight, that I'm just multiplying together. So that's what we're going to do. Now, how am I going to compute those Gaussians? What I need to do is, for each one of the Gaussians, there are two parameters. There is the mean, and then there's the variance. So how do I compute them? Charles has already gone through that. For the mean, it's quite simple. So here I'm computing the mean. Let's say I'm just doing the height, right? So mu of HA, that's the mean height of an adult. How do I get that? Well, I go into my data set. I go over all the instances which were classified as an adult. I take their height, and I just average them. And that gives me the mean height of an adult. To get the variance is also quite simple. What you're not seeing is the square up there. So this should be HI minus the mu of HA squared. Right. So what I do is, again, I go over all the instances which were labeled as an adult in the data set, and I see how far away they were from the mean, and I average those squared differences. And that is going to give me the variance of the height in adults. Once I've done that, I do the same thing for the weight. And again, this is just a Gaussian, which has a mean and a variance for an adult class. And then I have to repeat the same process for children. So overall, I'm going to end up with 8 different numbers. 2 numbers, the mean and the variance for the height of an adult, the mean and the variance for the weight of an adult, and the mean and the variance for the height and the weight of children. All right. So there's a nice example, but I think we're out of time. So I will stop here. Before you dash off, some people came in late. Please look on the course webpage. There are links there for signing up for labs and tutorials. Tutorials start next week, so you should sign up.
So we're almost a week ahead of last year.
Wow.
Maybe a lecture and a half ahead.
Which is good.
Which is really good.
So
because it means that once we get to
do something.
Yeah, once we get to the hard stuff, we can slow down, which I think is going to be great.
It's not actually terribly dense. Yeah, it is a lot. I think all of those, the ones that were sitting, they could have been propagated.
Oh, yeah. No, we're not overflowing.
Yeah.
We're not overflowing.
But it's, I think you're right.
Man, it probably is worth it. We'll see. We'll find out.
I think you asked me at some point for, I have a distribution of specialisms, if that's...
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, that is of interest, yes.
So
I can't, why did I want to know that? I don't remember, but it is of interest. I had a reason. I thought there was a specific reason why I wanted that. Now I don't remember what it was. Besides knowing how many people are doing mine, which is, of course, interesting. It always helps in terms of...
So this is computer science, software engineering, and high performance computing. And this is the count.
Wow, I didn't realize that was...
Yeah, I am stunned. I think it's Stratus.
Huh. What do you mean?
Stratus.
Yeah, what about him?
He taught extreme computing with Miles last year.
Yeah, that's right.
And,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't have any other explanation.
96, 141. So this is missing 40, right, you said?
No, this is 170 of them.
Oh, it's interesting. Oh, this is the number of students.
Yeah, so this is not based on ITO. This is, I had to pull it for IRR because the ITO went to give me the numbers.
Given the size of PMR, that's less than I would expect, right? Because there's usually 70 or 80 in PMR. So I guess there must be a lot of people outside the specialism who take it.
I don't know. Yeah. There must be, because this is silly.
Yeah.
Also a large UG4 cohort.
In PMR?
Well, I guess just in general, there are lots of UG4 and UG3 students. This
year. Yeah. So some of the UG4 might be taking.
So the MSc is certainly smaller. It was 220 last year.
And now it's 170. Year, so we
well, it's 170 sort of as of this morning.
Okay.
There could be more.
So it could be 50 less.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, but it's it's kind of.
Yeah.
So
that is
whatever
weird.
Whatever Frank was saying about NLP being immensely popular is right on.
Yeah.
What I don't understand is this.
Yeah.
I know we have bio students.
Yeah, something is weird, unless they're kind of taking them as part of the other specialisms or what. Because, I mean, on the one hand, it doesn't really matter.
I mean, any advisor, specialism advisor, can approve courses. Like, there's nothing stop. If somebody showed me a reasonable course schedule that had all database courses on it, well, I'd probably tell them to go to Stratus or something. But yeah, it is. Yeah, I don't know. It's strange. So, well, it's good to be number two at least.
I can email you.
Yeah, that'd be great, actually. Yep. Yeah.
This is awesome.
Wow. I mean, I'm far more. should I leave that up and inspire?
I don't know. This is like chalk empty.
Yeah. I think I might.
It's amazingly visible.
It's much more. Or do we even have an other? Yeah. Friends who raved about this were not wrong.
The mu x and the mu y equation were the mean values?
Yes, they were the mean of x and y.